Welcome or welcome back to The Buck Starts Here, the podcast that digs deep under the surface, examining the policies, people, and wild events that shape the presidencies of the United States. I'm Kyle, the Lewis to Eric Mason's Clark, and today we're joined by our first ever guest, our official presidential portraitist, Ray Faba. Ray, she's been my go-to art expert for the last 4 years or so, so we thought it'd be really interesting to bring her on to talk about some of the famous pieces associated with Washington. Eric, are there any particular ones maybe that you want to kind of lead us off with?
Yeah, I mean, if we're Lewis and Clark, does that make Ray our Sacagawea? She's going to guide us on this tour, this journey across the art world. Yeah, I mean, we're going to talk about the famous one, which is the Lansdowne portrait, which I can't wait to hear about, you know, Ray's understanding of that, because I'm a math guy, so I'm a math and history. I'm an econ guy, so art's like a whole different world to me. Favorite non-econ course I ever took was certainly art history, but that's quite low on the expertise in order to analyze the art side of it. But I think it's going to be really fun to talk about the painter, Gilbert Stuart, who had one of the wildest, absolutely wildest lives of some like tangentially significant historical figure to Washington. We can talk a little bit about the economics and the history of portraits, why they're so important. I know Ray can bring a lot of light to that case, too. I think we should really start at the beginning, which is Gilbert Stuart. So Gilbert Stuart, he was born in 1755, lived a pretty long life. He actually lived into the almost 1830. And he's probably the most famous portrait painter. Apparently, portraitist is not a word.
Damn it.
He was brilliant, but he was just, I don't want to be polite, but he was a degenerate. Like, he was, so he did all, pretty much any famous portrait of the Founding Fathers you can think of was done by Gilbert Stuart. He also did a lot of famous portraits in England, traveled all around the United States, painting and doing these commissions. And I don't want you to think that he was traveling to all these places and doing all this moving around, because he was like, I want to explore the world and I want to become I want to paint all the famous people. He was constantly in debt, never paid anybody back, and had 12 kids. And he would just like abandon them as he went along to different places to outrun creditors. Like he was just like completely degenerative. So Ray, let me kick this over to you, because I definitely want to go into more of the history of this. But I think it would be really cool to talk to hear from somebody who knows how to do this. How personal is a portrait? Like, if you're painting someone, what is it? That's not like taking a picture, right? Like, you get to know them. Like, how does that work?
Well, so there's sort of an evolution that happens in art. And for a long time, painting a portrait was just like taking a photograph.
Really?
Basically, you sitting in a chair, you were a still life to be represented as accurately as possible. Occasionally, you tried to be kind and maybe shave a couple of years off of someone's wife if they paid you a lot of money.
The original filter.
Increase your bust a little bit. Yeah, a little bit of original, like, photo filter kind of thing. We don't really start to see the humanization of, or the personalization of portraits until after the camera is invented. So pre-camera, you're really talking about artists or craftspeople. Stuart actually was a cartographer as well, and so those skills kind of went hand in hand. But this idea that you could reproduce natural features for posterity, I suppose, would be a good way to put it. I would say that a really important portrait, you would hope that you were trying to put some, that the artist would be unable to not put some bit of personality to it. Maybe, though, you didn't really spend time with that person back then. So Stuart would have gone in. I know, like, the Declaration of Independence painting, I think, is a good example of this. he sketched a couple faces based on where they were standing in a room, and then just kind of like filled a generic room in the background, and then filled in some other people that kind of looked like they might have been there, or maybe people who sort of paid into the fund for his paycheck, or, you know, that somebody maybe owed, this guy owed money to this other guy. Can he stick in the corner?
Right. Oh, my. I have a question for you now. So if you had enough money back in the day, could you just like pay to be painted into like a famous painting?
You could pay to be painted into a wonderful painting. So I think the, Kyle, you might have to dig for a slide of this one. The Portrait of the Arnolfini Wedding is a Jan van Eck painting. You've both seen it. It's a chap with a black cloak on and a hat, and his wife is in a green dress. And there's a big sort of sideways skull kind of in the middle, and there's a big mirror in the background and a chandelier. You've all seen this.
What was it called again?
The Portrait of the Arnolfini Wedding. Yeah, you've seen it. You trust me. It's like a girl with an ermine or a woman with a pearl earring. You've seen it. It's a Northern Renaissance classic. People pay big time money. These folks were merchants. They would have been, I guess, like upper middle class, not noble class, but, you know, within the economic smarty pants.
This one?
Money pants, I guess. Yep, that's her.
There we go.
She's not pregnant, by the way. That's a misunderstanding of modern viewership. But
I would hope not. She looks like she's 12.
The coolest thing in that picture is the mirror on the wall.
Oh, yeah.
So the mirror is the artist showing off. He can say, look at what I can do. His self-portrait is in that mirror. If you use a magnifying glass, you can see him. So he's showing off how good he can be with oil paint and how small of a brush he can use to be accurate. But they would have paid extra, sort of lube the artist up. Like, hey, you need to include all of this symbolism. So there's a bunch of stuff. Like, there's an orange on the windowsill, the little dog, the specific type of chandelier. And her dress, actually, is another one where you'd pay extra money to the artist and say, look how much money we have. Make us look really rich. Mm. So she's actually holding the dress up to let you know that she can afford... Her family can afford like 10 layers of petticoat underneath this dress.
So this is just Instagram flexing?
Yeah.
It is Instagram flexing.
People are all the same.
Yes, you could get...
We have not changed.
And if you understand art history and you can look at these things without our current cultural reference or without like sort of a reverence for the past, then you can say people have always been the same since the beginning of time. All of this stuff makes sense. So I guess the short answer, although this is kind of an off-topic example, it's just a good one that everyone has seen. Yes, you could pay the artist to make your painting better. And if you had more money, the artist was more inclined to spend more time, give you the features and the little imagery and the social cues and hints that you wanted in the painting.
Ray, I have a question for you now. You mentioned the artist... The kindness of them to shave a few years off. How much of the time was that kind of like, not necessarily like a suggestion, but more like a strong motivation for keeping your life or your employment?
You were certainly obligated under some circumstances to paint your subject in a favorable light.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And those obligations would be if you were British and the queen owned your land, you'd better not
exactly
make her sister look like a toothless prostitute. Absolutely.
Right.
So I guess that's kind of an interesting aspect of the portraits of the founding fathers and, you know, presidential portraits in general. Are they more like when I always find the portraits of the founding fathers to be very simple compared to that time period? Like, they're very direct. They are what they are. I mean, the famous Lansdowne portrait, like, it seems like Gilbert Stuart didn't even finish drawing out the table. He may have, like, there's only three legs on it.
So you're onto something. You're onto something there, Eric. The American Revolution happens at a time where some artistic styles are sort of bifurcating in Western European art. So what we think of as quote art, they're leaving sort of this Baroque and Rococo, very fantastic, beautiful. Think like the big twisty gold frames on paintings, and you go into a palace and every wall and every little bit of architecture is painted and gold flaked and has jewel insets in it. They're sort of leaving the Rococo, and the Enlightenment period starts to bring us closer to what we would call like realism. Hmm. The realism hasn't quite happened yet during the American Revolution. We're still looking back to ancient Greece and what we perceive from the old Hellenistic sculptures as the idealized human.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a little bit of idealism going on in the American Revolutionary portraits, but they're starting to lean towards more of the gritty end of real life So they're kind of caught at an intersection there.
Ray, do you think the influence of like scientific revolution and the Enlightenment, you know, especially with the scientific revolution being, you know, to accurately model living nature, the world around us. And I don't mean that from kind of like the Vitruvian Man and the Renaissance modeling, like, you know, bird wings, but in terms of, you know, if you're a scientist and you get into painting, you're going to want to reflect things and kind of the most, I love the way you term this, by the way, but kind of like a proto-realism. Do you think because, you know, the United States, it's brand new, nobody knows what a president is, really. That's such a weird concept, that they kind of just try to reflect them as, I hate to use the word plainly, because I could, these are absolute beautiful works of art, but not as grandiose. It's like, say, regalness. Late period Baroque. Great way to word that, Kyle. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think both of you are onto something with that. I think science, and specifically, and so my art history background is in the Neolithic, but I almost became an art conservationist. So I'm very interested in chemistry.
That's so cool. Wait, are you just going to drop that? That's what your background in art history is? Can we do a separate show on that? That's fascinating. What?
It's important for a reason. We date old paintings, but we didn't, when the people have been dead for 10,000 years, we date the old paintings by the materials they were made from. Mm-hmm. How sophisticated were the binders? What type of paints could they use? How fine of a ground is the material that makes the pigment? Yeah. And so science starts to change art at this particular intersection in a way that we hadn't seen since the Bronze Age happens. Hmm. So there's this huge change in the way paints are made and in the way that canvases are treated and the materials. And that becomes a craft and a science of its own.
Yeah.
So artists now finally in this like Enlightenment kind of pre-realist era are starting to really understand how light works, how chemistry works in a way that maybe they perceived during the Renaissance, but not, they didn't have a scientific background in it. So artists even today are trained in chemistry. And especially if you study oil painting, which was my studio concentration, you learn about all of these things. And that was the beginning of that. So absolutely, science affected how art was made. It affected the materials, the understanding of the materials, and in some ways it liberated the artists to say, well, you know, maybe before when all I was trying to do was depict like the best ermine coat and the greatest texture, but I know that that's all not real. Maybe I can say, because there's something more important here. A facial expression is more important. A certain nobility to a pose, not just a classical pose, but a human relation. So I think when you start to have chemists really putting, they had a word for them. I can't remember. I don't want to say they were called paint men, but they might've been called paint men. There was an entire group of people who branched off from art that were former artists that began doing all the chemistry. So I do think science had a huge impact. And I think that the way that, Eric, I don't think you mean to say that the founding fathers' portraits look plain, as in they look shabby or boring or it's IKEA furniture. I think what you mean to say is they seem to be carrying with them a spirit of regular people. And whereas we venerated royalty for and the clergy and in many, many, many arts going way back to the beginning of Christian painting in Europe, we have a new thing now. So maybe there was a little bit of scientific liberation and a little bit of philosophical liberation that guys like Stuart felt like, I'm not really bound to this convention any longer. And let's not forget my favorite thing in the whole wide world, propaganda.
Right.
Certainly the founding fathers were leading a revolution of the common, well, of the more common man, not the lowest common man, but the more common than the royalty. And they want it to be relatable. And there's a pressure on artists to please their patrons. So, you know, Washington might have said, don't paint me as a king.
Right.
Yeah. And this is, this is really interesting. So I guess my follow-up question I have on this is that if you're sitting down, you're Gilbert Stuart, as hilarious as your life has been, that's led you to sitting in front of the first president of the United States. There's no game plan for that type of portrait, like somebody who's the head of a country, but is the democratic head of the country, that is, just as you said, is somebody who's freely elected, whether you define what the we could have a whole different discussion on the enfranchisement, but for the first time since the Athenians, the person sitting that you're staring at is leading a country. At the time, it was already a very economically prosperous country on Earth. What, like, the individual citizens were credit, were much wealthier than the average Europeans. And you're sitting there and you're looking at that person. And you have no context for what that's like. You have no context for what a president is. You have no, it's a republic. Then this guy's ahead of it. Like, is he a king? But he wants to be called Mr. President. He doesn't even want to be called anything formal.
I'm surprised they didn't go the general route. Because, I mean, he was more well known as being a military leader. How come they didn't try to push that angle more?
Yeah, instead they go with this. Exactly. He's not in uniform. He's kind of just in, like, normal attire. He's in plainer attire.
I can answer those questions pretty easily. There's two questions here. One is there a game plan? How do you approach it? And then the second question is, why not a general? Because certainly he would have been well known as a general.
Right.
And then there's the third question of Calvinism that I don't know how to describe that, but there was this idea in Calvinism that
the elect,
plainness was its own virtue.
Right.
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 So I think, okay, I think first, Stuart is a lunatic, okay? his dad thinks that he's such a lunatic. His dad ships him off to England to go, like, go learn to paint or be a spy or just figure it out because you're a problem. So, you know, Gilbert's kind of, and I don't know Gilbert at all, Mr. Stuart, forgive me. If I were in that position and I were faced with a brand new project, I'd be like, great, time to go hog wild.
Right.
Like, what are they going to do? Fire me? And I'm already in debt. I've got 12 kids and 10 wives and, like, whatever. So I'm just going to go theoretically. And, you know, of course I'm being facetious, but, you know, he's faced with a brand new thing and he may have, it's very likely, in my opinion, as an artist, someone who paints every day, if I'm faced with a brand new thing, I'm like, screw it, man. Let's go. Let's go full pig. Mm-hmm. What can I get away with? What can I get away with here? How far can I push these people? Can I make a joke? Should I make a joke?
Bananas on Washington's head.
Can I put a banana on this guy's head? Can I put a banana on this guy's head? And we'll see what happens. So I think part of it is Stuart found himself in this position where he's doing the thing for the first time. And, like, he may have understood that if this goes well, he certainly understood if this goes well, I'm going to be the ground setter for them. And, like, that's a big thing for a gentleman with an ego in the way that he had. So I think that probably would have been a big thing. I can get really famous from this, doing it for the first time, being the groundbreaker. Others will have to follow in my path the way I've had to follow in the path of the masters who came before me. I'll be a master now. Mm-hmm. There's something about that. So that's generally the rule book with artists. When you're faced with something new, you try to go break new ground and then you try to get a following and then you're a movement. So that's the tradition. And then the question of general or not general, I think culturally the shift that's happening with Washington, I think Washington is driving a cultural shift there. Yep. We are no longer a nation at war. We are not a conquering nation. We are a nation of people who wanted to just be here to live our little Puritan lives and be left alone. I'm of that sort of Calvinist tradition, and I want to be seen as the dignified plain man. Please don't make me a general again. So I think those are all kind of intertwined.
I think that was a smart move on his part, too, because I think he did want to distinguish the fact that he was not a commander anymore, right? He didn't want to make it look like his rise to power was precipitated by his involvement or leader of the army, right?
He must have been very sensitive at the time to the idea that he was not going to replicate the British Empire mm-hmm. here.
Yes.
If you're
yes.
going to do that, yes. why don't you just a colony?
Oh, right. Yes. That's a great point because he was a huge believer in Cincinnatus, the famed Roman Hero. Dictator who then was like, I'm going back to my farm. I don't want to deal with this anymore. Right. That's a great point.
Cincinnatus is great though because he's a wonderful person to look to, and I know Washington referenced him in some of his famous speeches. Eric, don't forget to high five me because I heard you also brought the glasses thing up to Kyle, which is awesome. I love that. But my favorite thing about Cincinnatus was that he just wanted honest work. Mm-hmm. It's not much, but it's honest work. I'm happy to be, and this goes back to this Roman ethic of citizen, soldier, farmer, politician. Like, that these are roles that you play throughout your life, but they're in a limited time. They're not meant to be permanent. And I think Washington really, I can't imagine Washington approving a portrait of himself post-war in his general's outfit.
Yeah. The one that defined his presidency was not him stopping the whiskey rebellion.
Yeah, you know, it's hilarious.
Exactly.
Can I tell you what a very funny thing I found out about Gilbert Stuart? And I remember hearing this about 10 years ago, but I do like to prep for the shows because I both enjoy reading about this, and it's funny the stuff you hear as you live, and then it comes rushing back to you. Is that exactly what Ray said? So like Gilbert Stuart's dad sent him back to England. So Gilbert Stuart was born in Rhode Island. His dad was a Scottish immigrant who ran a snuff mill, like the tobacco, yeah. Which is just very funny to me. And then he was like, wow, my son is talented, but it's also crazy. So he's like a complete degenerative, took no responsibility. So he shipped him back to England. And he studied under Cosmo Alexander. And he was kind of the guy who showed him this, like, it's classical painting. I'm sure there was more than just the concept of classical painting. But, like, Cosmo Alexander dies. Actually, like, he dies, like, he starts training Gilbert Stuart. It's not like, hey, you know, he passed away after, you know, 5, 10, 15, like, after good mentorship. Just, like, 2 years in as he starts rolling up, or a little more than 2 years in, Cosmo Alexander dies. And he doesn't really know what to do. And his dad's still in the U.S. He's Scottish, so, like, he didn't really know what to do. So he ends up going to London and going under, an American-born painter who's over in England, Benjamin West. And Benjamin West is a kind of really cool dude because he's big into neoclassicalism. He's big into naturalistic representations. But he was actually the first guy to kind of show Stuart this exposition of portrait style art. And he's getting ramped up. He's having fun. So this is like, he teams with Benjamin West in 1775. He goes through this and, you know, I'm sure Ray could tell us, you know, it's not like going to school and getting a master's degree in, you know, business administration. Like art's, I believe I've heard, my friends have described it as a constant dialogue between yourself and the canvas. And I always kind of like that. But he's in like the middle of this whole, like, you know, he starts off with his basics, neoclassicalism, naturalism. And just as Ray said, you know, this time starts evolving. We see this kind of shift in art. But that happens like right in the late 1780s. And West is like, hey man, I'm going to like, you know, let's keep training on this. And Gilbert Stuart's like, I got to go back to the U.S. And they're like, oh, he's like, oh, why? He's like, because I owe a bunch of people money and I don't think they're going to follow me to this new country. And he just dipped out. Like, the minute the Constitution formed, Gilbert Stuart was like, all right, cool. I owe a ton of money to a lot of people, so I'm going to head back over to the U.S. And he came back to Boston. Before he then went everywhere, running away from people who owe money.
I think the word you're looking for there, Eric, is scallywag. Scallywag, yeah.
What an interesting dude. And I don't know how these people, how does that work, Ray? If somebody wanted to, like, how do you find the person to paint you a portrait? Like, I can't imagine, it's like, you don't go on, like, Fiverr, right? And this is, like, the 1780s. Like, how does this, do you climb up a ladder or something?
Yeah, basically, you don't get a portrait paid if you're below a certain economic standing, right? Like, you just don't. Those doors are just closed to you. It's like the public library. It didn't exist back then. You're none for you. So you would have, say, you were a wealthy person and your wife just had a baby and managed to survive childbirth and the child made it to 2 years and you're like, great, time to have a family portrait made because this one's probably going to make it. And so you might think back, well, where have I seen some paintings that I liked? You know, Bob, the snuff factory owner down the road, had a nice portrait at his house. Hey, Bob, who did your thing? Oh, this dude, but he's dead, but his student lives a couple towns over. So, you know, you might invite that person to come, wine and dine them, say, you know, what would it cost to do a portrait? So there's a lot of like handshaking and interpersonal connections. And Stuart's uniquely positioned because studying under someone with a reputation kind of granted you a little piece of that reputation as well.
Instant credibility.
So now he can come back to Boston and he can say, hey, I need to make some money. He might even have the town crier or put out a notice at the local pub that, hey, if anyone's died recently or needs a portrait or was born recently or married, I'm open to doing those. Here's my resume, right? And here's who I've worked under. And he would get a foothold that way by reputation.
And he told them not to check his credit history.
So in a way, like, it was a lot easier. And Eric, I don't have an answer to this, but maybe you and I could look it up sometime just for grins. I wonder how many artists back then, especially like portrait artists, took payment and then just left.
Just dipped out. I do love that.
Like, got my money. Like, I mean, could you, is that like another, like, I'm always joking with Kyle about, oh, that's how you rob a bank, right? You know, you get a seat on the board of directors.
Right.
And, you know, I don't need a gun. I just need to be a seat on the board of directors. So like, if I can rob that bank without actually having to. So I wonder how many people back then were able to get away with that. It seems unfathomable to me sitting here in 2024 and being like a middle-aged artist going, never in my lifetime could you have gotten away with this. But then I remind myself, D.B. Cooper was just 10 years before I was born.
Right.
You could still pull off a mystery heist 10 years before I was born. And this was like 150, 200 years ago. What could those guys have gotten away with? So it'd be interesting to know what's the statistic on that.
What about the other side of the equation, though? What about how often was somebody displeased with their portrait and refused to pay?
Frequently.
Yeah, I bet.
that was a confident yes. answer, right? You
I felt like that was a little bit of today, too.
It still happens. We do have records. You know, artists sent lamenting letters to their families saying, you know, this guy screwed me out of however much for this portrait. I'm out the materials. They've absconded with the painting. I can't even paint over it and do something else. Mm. They refuse to pay me. They're unhappy because their wife has buck teeth. That's not my fault. we have letters that artists and begging their families for money because this happened. So I think, you know, just like anything, like, that's a gentleman's agreement. We're sort of free from that now because our economy and our social lives are so transactional and contracted.
With social media too, reputation follows you a lot further.
Yeah. So like, you know, if someone, okay, for example, there's a small niche museum near where I live, and I won't divulge it now because it's gossip, but I'll tell you guys after we're done recording. Didn't pay an artist for a lot of work that was done in the building. And that artist turned around and she proceeded to let everyone for like 200 miles around know. And now this woman can't get any work done.
Yep.
So the artist never recovered. She never recovered her money, but this woman is never going to be able to hire another artist. And every time someone comes in to the community who's new and says, oh, I'm going to go work at blank blank museum, we're like, no, 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 no. You know who she didn't pay?
Right.
So I mean, certainly some of that happened back then too. Like maybe some artists who stole got blacklisted, or some patrons who didn't follow through on their end of the agreement got blacklisted. But Stuart seems to have avoided all of this by some weird stroke of like good astrological birth sign that he just avoids. He doesn't ever, in what I've read of his history, he's never faced any repercussions.
No, absolutely not. So he's
no one came for him.
In preparation of this, so his grave's in Boston. So I did some homework on it. So he had no money when he died, like no money, absolutely nothing. And it wasn't because like the creditors finally got him. I mean, he still had some creditors here, but it's basically because he was horrible with money. So he's buried. He had no gravestone, no marker on his grave. Then after, it wasn't even that long. It was like 20, 30 years. People were like, dude, this guy made a bunch of famous portraits. We have to, we got to put a monument on there. So they eventually erected like this, like, you know, pretty nice monument, pretty nice grave marker. And he's like this lauded, portrait painter.
Portraitist.
And he never got portraitist. And he never, like, the guys from England never came over and messed with him. He never had, like it didn't end bad for him. He just, it ended bad for him in a sense that, like, he was bad with money, and if we were bad with money, bad things happen. But it wasn't like some creditors broke his leg or something.
Right.
My favorite one, Ray, I'll let you say the story because you said it really good in the pre-show, the humor on this, but just the quick background on it. So, like the Lansdowne portrait, right? That's the famous portrait from that you see hanging, his hands up, the missing leg on the stool.
And is it the Anatheum? Am I saying that right?
Yeah, Anatheum, yeah.
Anatheum.
So the Lansdowne one was never, that wasn't like commissioned to be the presidential portrait. So Senator William Bingham, he made that as a gift for the Marquis of Lansdowne, who was a British Marquis who was like supportive of the, I don't want to say like supportive of the revolution. He was more just like European nobility who was like, again, I want to sound supportive because obviously you don't want to like mess with the king and like all that going around. But he was like, he was just very pro-American. Let's say he was pro-American, wasn't really anti-anything. And we were just like, dude, that'd be sick to put in the White House. And I often wonder how that discussion went down with Senator Bingham. No, I made this for like my buddy. It's like, nah, but we're gonna put it in this house we're building. It's like, oh, thanks. But Ray, if you could go into what you said in the pre-show about what he did with the Anthem portrait and let's say subsequent print runs of it.
So Martha commissioned the Anathema portrait, which is interesting because it's one of the few portraits we have of her. She, according to Washington's letters, seemed to have been a bulwark in their lives, or what we have left. She actually destroyed most of their communication. I think she really didn't, I don't know, she didn't want anything to do with the whole thing. Like, she wanted to keep a private, quiet life. So it's noteworthy that she decides we're going to have these portraits painted. You know, let's get this famous guy, portraiteur, who does whatever we're calling it. We'll get this artist, we'll do these portraits, and it will be great. We'll have one of each of us, and that'll be like, okay, family legacy. So Stuart paints them, and the way these paintings worked at the time, you would sketch in, you know, you can't have a person sit for like 20 or 30 hours that it takes to do a painting.
Right.
Even I paint fast and I'm a phobist, so it's non-specific, lots of big colors, cartoony type stuff. And it's still, I mean, even on something that's 3 feet by 5 feet, I mean, it's 14, 15 hours of work just to cover a canvas. It's a lot of work.
Absolutely amazing.
So they'd sketch out the face and like maybe do like a little stick figure for the body, a couple like line indications, maybe where they wanted to have like a plant or a window. And around the head, they would do a dark halo. And that would just be so that they could build out the hair. And the wigs were super important at the time. So get that wig looking fluffy and contrasting from a background. It's that far, and he's gonna allegedly take it back to his studio and finish it, them both. And instead he shows it to everyone, and it's very popular, so he starts having reproductions made. And he starts selling the reproductions, and I think I refer to it like out of the boot of his wagon, like you put like homemade booze out of your car. He's like bootlegging it out of his covered wagon, like he's going from town to town and selling these things. And I'm not sure that he ever told anyone. I don't know that the Washingtons knew that he was out there increasing his profit, like the underwear gnomes from South Park.
Right. Step three, profit.
So, and I'm honestly, I could not recall for you how much the Washingtons paid him for the paintings, but they were in his possession. I'm not sure that they ever went back to the Washington family home. I think that he kept them.
There's a lot of evidence they did it. There is an immense amount of evidence they did it.
Yeah, that he proceeded to just copy them and then have his students copy them and sell cheap reproductions.
So do you know what's wild? I have on the other side of the screen, like the show notes, and I have a picture of the Anthem painting. And I can literally see the brown halo. You can see it like so.
Yeah.
Can you put so that?
It's a.
Do you screen share that?
Yeah, sure.
We would call that a sketch. And like, I think what we say in modern colloquial parlance, a sketch is like, it's like the cartoon that someone draws at Six Flags of your kids or whatever. But sketch really is. It's the thing that goes under the finished painting. So it's the work that you do at the very beginning and you build off of sketch, and sketch becomes finished piece. So yeah, you can see that it's a big circle. It's a big circle back there. So he would have charcoaled in the skull and the hair, and then made the big circle behind it, and then worked with that circle as his reference for. So now that halo and the brown square behind Mr. Washington's head, he could turn that into anything. He could cover that back over with like some white or some cream and make it a wall. He
lazy jerk left it blank. He didn't even finish the portrait.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, he didn't need to finish it. Like, I think my favorite part of it is it's all crammed up into the upper right-hand side. That's right. My favorite. I love that. I think it's really interesting how, like, the reason I love it is that putting the subject in the upper right-hand corner and leaving a bunch of empty space around it is an incredibly modern and forward-thinking, like, modern art way of thinking, the school of study that I came through. And really, it was just an accident. He didn't really mean to do it that way. But it's kind of fun.
You saying he didn't intend to not finish this?
No, he did not intend to not finish it. He intended, I'm sure. I'm sure he walked out of there with this. Probably not most of like the colors in the face, but at least like something that looked close to this. I'm sure he walked out of Washington's house with it thinking, I'm going to finish this thing. And
got drunk.
If ifs and buts were candies and nuts, we'd all have a good Christmas. Right.
So if anybody listening, just listening to it, if you want to see the portrait we're talking about, it's the portrait from the $1 bill.
Yeah.
That's where this eventually went to.
Yeah. It is the most famous portrait of George Washington ever. And it's unfinished.
His students drew every single one of those early dollars is what I heard. And they sold it out of the boot of his car.
I know we're pressing up on time a little bit, but there's one more thing I want to talk about, and it's a little off the Gilbert Stuart train, so I'm going to bring it up.
I'm all for it.
But it's the, you probably already know this, it's the painting of the Treaty of Paris.
That's the one was confusing it with, yeah.
Which is my favorite portrait of all time, because it is, the British just were like, we don't want to be here anymore. We lost to the Yankees. And all the people who have tried to fill in the rest of the painting is the best part about it.
Yeah, so this is a fun one. What do you do as an artist when you've got a group of people sitting and half of them are like, we're out? Well, and it's interesting. My guess is, and I'm gonna step out on a limb also here and say Gilbert is right-handed. Not just because most people are right-handed, but because of where he starts.
Oh. So you have the blank canvas as
so
you work across?
On the left side, because when you start, so I'm ambidextrous, so sometimes I draw with my left hand and sometimes I draw with my right hand. If I'm drawing with my left hand, I work from right to left so that my hand doesn't drag through the chalk and the charcoal on my way through when I'm sketching. So he starts on the side that is natural for him and he gets some people drawn in. People get up and shift, they move around. Your sitters have to have like some time to rest their legs. You could really only ask someone to sit even in a chair and hold a pose for about an hour. They start to fidget. It's really fascinating. Life drawing class is a ton of fun. You put tape on the floor. Now you put tape on the floor in the hopes of people like, well, put your left foot there. Or like you draw like a chalk outline of their foot, like put your foot on that so that we know where you were. So, you know, there's all this chaos anyways, when you have a group of sitters. And my impression of this is that he goes through from left to right, as he would do with his right hand, and he gets his people drawn in and he's sort of working his way over and everything goes to pot. And it's like, well, what do I do now?
I love that you can tell he loved Benjamin Franklin because he's the only one who's fully dry, looking fly.
Well, he may have also taken it back with him and tried to resurrect some idea that this could be finished somehow. Like maybe if I can fill in the guys I do have sitting and, you know, I can get right. So as we roll through, like, so I get this guy in and then I'll get the guys around him and then we get some background in. And I don't know, this area where the British were supposed to be, maybe I can find something else to put there. And again, it doesn't work out. And it seems like, you know, there's a particular luck here that like, the fact that the British aren't there tells its own story.
Yeah, right.
And so again, that's my modern art bias. Like that's my post-Enlightenment non-realist art bias that like when you don't include something that's just important as including it, sometimes more important. So he probably took this back and worked on it. I'd like to know this though, and I don't know. So maybe Eric can answer this question from me. How much did Franklin kick into the kitty to get this painting done?
Oh, you know it was a lot. He was big on stuff like that.
He got painted first? He was a lunatic.
Yeah, he was amazing. I have one last thing I'd like to bother you on, Ray. And I know I keep saying that, but this has been so fascinating.
Right.
So the first president to ever have his picture taken was John Quincy Adams. So every president since then, we've had photography for.
Yeah.
So how important would you say portraits are to today? I mean, we know the famous even contemporary Obama in the tan suit portrait, which looks, I'm just going to be apolitical opinion here, looks absolutely amazing. That portrait is one of my favorite presidential portraits. But how important are portraits today? Like, we don't do death masks anymore. Are portraits still important?
Yes. Portraits are incredibly important. So to kind of clarify, we do have official White House photographers and photographic portraits, portraitists. I don't know. We're going to have to find out what that word is.
Yeah,
that,
we do. Yes, we do.
There's got to be a term. Look it up, Kyle. There's got to be a term.
All right, fine. But like,
our nation as a whole, we all kick in a little bit from our federal taxes and we commission a painting to be done of our important people. So our presidents get official photographic portraits, but they also still get painting. Awesome. And there's something that's really important about this idea that leaving something behind, right? So I used to have people tell me, and I knew probably from the time I could articulate verbally that I wanted to be an artist. I just was one of those people. I knew my purpose from the beginning. I wasn't like Steve Martin in The Jerk. I always knew my special purpose. And
I know my special purpose.
I was like, people said, you know, sensible people in my life, sensible adults who wanted to guide me down, you know, the path of being an attorney or an engineer or something said, you know, art's not very important. This is not, you know, a good way to spend your time. You're very bright. Why are you, you know, so determined to do? But I would say this, and this is something that I think stays in our cultural consciousness somehow. There's something passed down from generations, but you know, we know very little about ancient Rome, for example.
Yeah.
But it's in their art. Mm-hmm. I know very little about my ancestors, the Magdalenian people who painted on the cave walls in Lascaux, but I see their art. Mm-hmm. So when everything else is gone, when the buildings rot away, when the bones are smashed up into, you know, fossil fuels, when the landscape changes because glaciers come in and floods happen, but the art that people leave behind, their art and their architecture, is something that is long lasting. So I think that we still, as a culture, see portraiture and portrait art as something that has a generational value, that is something that will give a legacy to us as a culture. So I think that's baked into us somehow. I don't really know why, but that would be my theory. Maybe you need an anthropologist to come on and really ask that
question.
That's
an awesome answer.
I know,
right?
I mean, God. Like,
that was an amazing answer. What are you talking about? I would love an anthropologist to come on here because I have a bunch of bizarre questions.
I think you guys should get David Ian Howe. I'm putting my vote in for David Ian Howe.
I want you both on so you can explain to me how mummy brown became a color. Like, who was like, let's grind up some mummies and put them into paint. This will be productive.
Dude, hang on. I might know something about that. I remember reading, like, back in, like, the 20s, there were so many mummies in ancient Egypt, or in Egypt at the time, that they didn't have enough, like, wood to burn for fires. They were actually, like, legit, like, lighting mummies on fire to burn for warmth.
No, Kyle, I can understand, like, there not being enough wood, but who was like, let me ground up this old guy?
That's the point. There was so many of them that everybody in ancient Egypt wanted to be mummified.
I like Kyle's idea of using the resources that you have.
Yeah.
What's at hand. I think that speaks to like human ingenuity. But the reason mummy brown becomes a thing, whether it started as we just have so much of this, let's just see what color it makes. The chemicals that the Egyptians used, the oils and the chemicals that they used, caused a sort of like, well, it's chemical reaction. So a lot of paint is chemistry. Mm-hmm. And they found that this was the only source that they could get this color from. Of course, now we have synthetic mummy brown because of the miracle of modern polychromatic.
Of like, running, the miracle of running out of polymer, mummies?
Yes.
polymer is amazing. And the miracle of running out of mummies. Although we could have just started mummifying.
Yeah, I was going to ask. There would have been an economic incentive to actually bring them back.
Yeah. So, like, but really, the truth of the matter is that it was a specific chemical reaction that was happening that caused those colors. And once people learn how to reproduce it, then they stop having to grind up mummies.
Oh, the dead bodies are not necessary, I guess.
How weird was the first dude to do that? How, like, bizarre.
How weird eat a chicken.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I know.
but like, the egg. You can be like, chicken is food. What type of food did my food make? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, you get, like, I don't eat veal, but I get the concept of eating veal.
Just the idea that I'm gonna try to use like this thing for food, or I'm gonna try to use this thing to build a boat, or I'm gonna try to use this thing to make paint is actually pretty common in human history. Like,
that's kind of a kid thing.
Experimenters.
So look at the,
yeah.
Think of it. Kids. Playing. How many soups did you make? Yeah.
No, I agree with you. You guys are right. Okay, so I retract my previous point, but I want to stick on this for a sec, because the way I'm thinking about it is that I don't think there were like mummies lying around outside, and some little kids like, oh, it rain. Like, I get how we got wine. I get how we got beer. Like water fell into something with yeast with some sprouted yeast in it. Now we got beer. You can sell me on that, but like, what dude was like, I'm going to be grave robbing? Because here's the thing, like, there was grave robbing going on for several thousand years before this.
Well, Eric, let me tell you the history of artists and grave robbing.
Okay, good. I like that.
Bonus content.
It is not a far stretch for artists to be digging things up out of the ground for hopes of either finding materials or knowledge in the dead, whether newly dead or the long-term dead. So that's pretty common. And actually, even as recently as when I was in college in the late 1990s, I still attended classes at NYU, which was just across town from my school, where the medical students were doing cadaver dissection. And you could apply to go and draw the muscles and the organs and the bones while they were being taken apart. This has always been, human anatomy has always been a huge part of art.
Da Vinci.
And back in the day, there wasn't a college that you just went to, like a medical school, and said, yo, can I sit in while you do your dissection and do some drawing? It was like, under cover of darkness, artists digging. Da Vinci did this.
The church did not like that.
Digging bodies up and taking them apart to understand. So the idea of grinding up a body, whether it's to hide the evidence of your grave theft or whatever, or if you want to try out some new paint materials, it doesn't seem so strange to me, because that in the world that artists live in, that's like, well, that's part of our history. Like, maybe I'm more forgiving than you are.
Wasn't Da Vinci like a big grave robber? Like, he spent a lot of time dissecting bodies and drawing.
I thought Ray was going to tell us a grave robbing story, that she was like, yeah, so you would, on my way to NYU, I'd swing by a local cemetery and see what I could pick up.
Yeah, you know that John Adams crypt you walk by every day? It's empty.
Damn painters destroying U.S. history.
I'm not advocating for the robbing of graves, nor will I admit publicly to having done it myself. However, I will say that's a common throughout history.
That was awesome.
That was so good. So good.
Ray, that was a blast. That was so much fun.
Yeah, it was really fun. I love it. I love talking about art. It's always a thrill.
That was a blast.
All right, so I think we decided to use the POTUS ranking for our presidents. So we're gonna score them on five categories. Yeah, it's the political influence, so the president's ability to shape political landscapes, including their impact on party dynamics, legislative agendas, long-term political shifts. Overall governance will assess the effectiveness of their administration's implementing policies, managing the federal bureaucracy, maintaining stability and governance. Transformational leadership, the president's ability to enact significant changes or reforms that alter the course of history. Understanding of public needs for you. How well the president understood and responded to the needs and concerns of the American public, and strategic vision, the clarity and ambition of their vision for the country. Did they have a forward-thinking approach that guided their decisions and inspired hope for the future? So, Eric, let's start with the P then.
Political influence. I think you would be hard-pressed to find a president who had greater political influence on the United States at any given point in their tenure than Mr. Washington. So I would give him a 7 out of 7 on that.
Yeah, I don't know that I could disagree with that. Overall governance, then, the effectiveness of their administration in implementing policies and managing bureaucracy.
My thoughts on this, I would say probably on a scale, yeah, if we're going 1 to 7, I would probably say a 5.
I feel like it needs to get dinged a little bit for having to quash rebellions by grabbing the army to show up. That kind of gives a little bit of a hit.
Yeah, and I think any president that has a pronounced recession during their tenure, I think gets excluded from being, you know, number one. But, you know, 5 out of 7 is still very good. Is a very good score.
Yep. All right, leadership?
Oh, 7 out of 7. He set the precedent. he's the president of precedent. It would be weird. It would be very bizarre if it was anything lower than that, right? for Mr. Washington.
All right. I'm going 7. Understanding of public needs.
See, I'm going to go controversial here. I'm going to go back down to 5 for him.
Why?
And I think leading an army against a rebellion as a sitting president may not be reflecting what the public, let's say, wants versus needs, but... I think he had to make a lot of really tough decisions. And I think a lot of those decisions were positioning America to be an effective trader without getting tied up in European alliances. And I think the Jay Treaty is kind of a good example that we talked about that separation. The public wanted more involved trade, particularly, to be honest with you, particularly with Britain, because a lot of these people who were living in the colonies at the time that then became the United States already had business affairs with the Brits. So they wanted to return to normalization as quickly as possible. But Washington, in his, I would say, wise, if you look at the history of the 1800s, decision to remove America from, you know, these overly interlocked treaties in England, kind of went against the public's economic benefit. But in the long run, it was probably right. But at the time, that's why I would say understanding or, you know, fulfilling public needs effectively would probably be not
the perfect score. Convoluted treaty structure of Europe kind of led to some other issues later in the 1900s, if I remember correctly. So it was probably a smart move.
In the 2000s.
What's that, right?
Oh, you don't say.
Right.
Ray's like, let me tell you about this Austrian artist.
There was this guy that kicked out of art.
Right. Yeah, that is true. Let me tell you about this failed Austrian artist.
Eric, so are we going to ding him because maybe he had a better understanding of what the country needed than what the public wanted, or do we have to grade him on what the public wanted versus what he did?
Yeah, I think this is one. So I'm interpreting this as a populist question.
Yes.
Did he do what the people wanted him to do as opposed to what he thought was best?
Gotcha. Okay. Strategic vision, then. Last one here.
I'd be a hypocrite if I didn't give him a 7 out of 7 after what I just said previously. Railed against the two-party system, 2 terms in office, peaceful transition of power, and stay out of Europe stuff, focus on trading, be allies with Canada. I mean, like, I go on and on and on. Like, it's just, he knew what was coming down the pipeline. He really did.
Well, I think we set a pretty high bar for the next president to follow. That gives him a 5.
Yeah, who would have thought George Washington would be the guy with the high 5?
He better end up probably in the top 4. We're going to have to redesign the Mount Rushmore.
Yeah.
Ray, do you have any final thoughts on Washington before we close this thing up?
You know, I think you guys got to cut Mr. Washington a little bit of slack on account that he was kind of operating without a handbook.
Yes, that's a great point.
I think it's really easy to deify George Washington. My brother is a huge fan. Everyone in our family who's an artist has given him a George Washington portrait, you know, painting, scene or a portrait over the years. And, you know, because we deify trailblazers, we say like the first guy to go to the moon, the first guy to figure out how to make fire or cook a chicken. I don't know. That one was just a silly one, but
big fan of the colonel.
But you've got to give a little bit of grudging respect for someone who's doing it for the first time. Like, this was, the world hadn't seen, and our republic is very different than Hellenistic Athens. I would even go so far as to say the world had never seen a republic like ours until Washington started to lay out the foundations for what that would be. So, you know, it's hard for me to ding the guy on anything because, like, it's brand new.
But
honestly, hard to be brand new.
I think that the idea was to try to model it more like Athenian society or government structure with the way they did the Articles of Confederation. But I think Washington had a better understanding that knowing that the infighting between them. Yeah, exactly. The infighting is what took them down, and he probably recognized that strong central government was what was needed to hold all that together.
Right. And so, I mean, maybe the best thing we could say about Washington is, like, I would hope that Mr. Washington looked back on Athens and said, we can learn from our past and improve on it. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's how we should look at his legacy now and say, like, we can look at this and use it as a starting point and improve everything that we have, because the foundations of it are good.
I love that.
So that's what I have to say.
I love it.
Thank you, Ray. Thank you so much for you, stopping by and informing us on some of the nuances.
We're back in the China shop.
I know, right? It's been a little while, huh? Thank you, everybody, for sticking around. I think we did manage to finally get through everything we wanted to cover with Washington, although there's still a ton of other stuff that I think we'll probably want to cover at some point. There's just so much that we
wanted. Banana farmer.
I know. So I think next time you hear from us, we'll probably be kicking off our John Adams presidential coverage. Until then, you can find us at thebuckstartsherepodcast.com, and we'll see you all next week.